From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Mohammed El-Shenawy, Middle East reporter in VOA's English division. Our topics on this edition of the program: can Libya enforce a power-sharing agreement in light of recent deadly attacks on a police training center and on oil terminals? A huge bomb attack on a police training center in the Libyan western coastal city of Zliten killed at least 50 recruits. On January 4th, the so-called Islamic State group attacked the country's biggest oil ports, setting storage tanks ablaze. The rise of IS in Libya adds urgency to international efforts to broker a peace deal between Libya's two rival administrations, one based in Tripoli, backed by Islamist groups, and the other, an internationally recognized government, in Tobruk. The governments signed the UN-brokered power-sharing deal last month, but they have yet to form a unity government. And can Tunisia, the only democracy that remains in the wake of the popular Arab uprisings it sparked in December 2011, live up to expectations? We'll talk about these issues with our valued guest, William Lawrence. He's visiting professor of political science and international relations at George Washington University. He was former director of the North Africa and Middle East programs at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. Well, William Lawrence, welcome back to the program.
It's nice to be back.
And as always, I'm very delighted to have my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawy, on the show.
Thank you.
William Lawrence, also known as Bill, here at the microphones. Tell us about the status of the power-sharing agreement in Libya, which is being seen as all the more critical in light of inroads being made by the Islamic State group, also known as ISIS-Daesh.
Well, it is critical. And because it's so critical, that's the only reason I think we have an agreement right now. It's fragile. It's even faltering. We don't even have a majority of either of the rival parliaments supporting it yet. We've had the president of each parliament reject it. And yet everyone's forging ahead with the agreement because without an agreement, things look much worse in Libya. I think the problem with the UN process from the very beginning is that they kept announcing victory going back to June 2014 and successive announcements when they didn't have buy-in from key political players, and they've never had buy-in from the militias that actually control things on the ground. So the main variable right now is the better Islamic State does, I think the better the agreement does. And if Islamic State, ironically, is beaten back by this coalition of forces that seems to be coming together to fight it, actually that makes it the agreement even weaker because it's not standing on very firm ground.
Well, that's interesting. So what you're saying is that this mutual enmity by the government in Tobruk and now the government in Tripoli, the rival governments, that this mutual enmity toward ISIS, what's really, you know, keeping it together, they aren't able to bridge. What are the other differences that they seem to be unable to bridge?
It's not the only factor, but it's the factor that's driving things right now, particularly driving the international community, which is a major player in all this. Libya, as you may remember, is one of the only countries created by the UN in 51. It's being sort of recreated by the UN process right now. And so what the international community is saying looms much larger in Libya than it would in another country. But the points of contention are varied. I think the probably stickiest one is the future of General Haftar, the self-proclaimed head of the Libyan army, who then became named head of the Libyan army faction by the Tobruk government, and who has spent the vast amount of his resources available fighting Libya Dawn, the other side, and not fighting ISIS, and lumping all of those of an Islamist persuasion from moderate Democrats over to radicals in the same basket, and then not winning very many battles because he's turned about 60% of Libya against himself. His future is the sticking point in Libya. I think if he goes, Tobruk gets weaker, but the agreement does better. And I think if he stays, the agreement won't stand.
Let me turn to my colleague Mohammed for a question.
Bill, the peace deal is calling for a national unity government, an end to fighting between forces loyal to the two competing parliaments. Is it still up to the armed groups on the ground to comply with that agreement?
Yes. As I said, the militias really matter hugely and haven't really played a major role in the negotiations. One thing we learned during the negotiations is how both sides could fragment. And the fragmenting going on the Libyan Dawn side was the Misratans breaking away from the Tripoli-based parliament and forces, and the Zintanis from the Western Mountains breaking away a little bit from Tobruk's control and forming sort of a middle ground in favor of the agreement. But increasingly, with the fragmentation of loyalties both on the militia side and the political side, more and more any particular Libyan at a negotiation is representing himself and a few friends and not really the municipality or the army or the parliament that they claim to represent. So there's sort of a good and a bad side to this fragmentation that's going on. It's made this partial agreement possible, but it also weakens everybody's role at the table.
But the major opponents of this agreement are insisting to have amendments, which means renegotiating the deal. Is that still an option?
Depends who you talk to. It has to be an option because this isn't an agreement that has enough buy-in, so there still need to be amendments. And these are the same issues going back to July. They were saying, well, they're not really amendments, they're details in the annexes. And there's a way you could sort of finesse a lot of what's still outstanding to be negotiated as details in the annexes, except one or two things having to do with another major sticking point, which is the composition and membership of the State Council, which is a second parliamentary body, which would be part of this two parliamentary body system. And this second parliamentary body would absorb a lot of the members of the current Tripoli parliament. And so the future of this group would have to be spelled out to a degree in an amended agreement. It's funny, each time they announce a deal, we don't see a text of that deal. And often at the last minute, as UN representatives are tweeting out to the parties that they need to sign on immediately or be subject to sanctions, what's really going on in part is a sort of last minute negotiation on the sticking points, which never really bears the fruit it's intended to bear. So honestly speaking, a solid deal in Libya does need further amendments. What they call the amendments, how they finesse it is another matter.
So given the challenges, obviously, with this agreement, William Lawrence, how optimistic are you that it can be implemented? And what are the consequences if it isn't?
Not optimistic at all for the short term. As one senior U.S. administration official told me in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, he said, I'm not really worried about whether or not there'll be a deal in Libya. I'm worried about what happens if we get a deal, making it work. That's the much harder deal. I think Libya has some strengths, as I've talked about before in this program. One of the strengths is that the municipalities are quite strong and armed. You have sort of 100 or so functioning municipalities to some degree with their own little armies. That could be the basis of a stable Libya going forward. And many of the municipalities, in contradiction to the members of parliament and the militias I was talking about, many of the municipalities are in favor of this deal. So you could imagine a scenario where Libya gets sort of rebuilt up from the ground, almost in some ironic ways, Gaddafi's dream, right? A Jamahiriya of independent communities, right, armed and defending themselves, and that would bode well for a stable Libya. What's not going on, and going back to your first question, is that nobody's fighting ISIS effectively. Not Libya Dawn, not Libya Dignity, who spent much more time fighting each other. The main rivals have been other radical jihadists who just don't like their shade of jihadism, or petroleum guards, because there's a major attack going on this week. I think there are 7 oil tanks on fire as we speak. And IS is trying to take oil facilities in Ras Lanuf and El Sidr area. And these attacks are being defended by the petroleum guards. Now, these are the same petroleum guards who were illegally selling oil. You might remember the Morning Glory operation where the U.S. Special Forces interdicted an oil sale in Crete a year or two ago. So we have the very guards who were illegally selling oil, the last bastion right now defending Libya's oil against IS, and they put out a call this past week asking for any and all willing to defend Libya's oil facilities to come and help defend it, because IS is having a second wave of attack over the last month right now, and it's not looking great right now.
Just to quickly go back real quick, you mentioned Libya Dawn and Libya Dignity. Quickly define those groups again for us.
So Dignity came together in mid-May 2014 with General Haftar's attack on Benghazi and then attack on Tripoli. And that's often the grab bag term for everyone aligned with the Tobruk government, either strongly or weakly. And then Dawn are those aligned with the Tripoli government. And they came together in July of 2014 in defense of Tripoli and then to take the Tripoli airport. often each side, this is sort of a chicken and egg thing here, blames the other side for attacking first. But the fact of the matter is that the first attacks as an organized force were from Haftar. And prior to that, there was a series of assassinations which caused this backlash, assassinations of civil society leaders and stuff you may have heard about.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA with our guest William Lawrence, visiting professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, an expert on North Africa. We're talking about Libya. Now a question from Mohammed.
Well, before the break, we were talking about the Islamic State group expanding in Libya east, west, and to the south. What role can the international community play to prevent Libya from becoming a safe haven for these terrorists attacking neighboring countries like Egypt and Tunisia?
Well, this is an extremely important question. And for years now, some experts, Dirk van der Waal, one of the main UN advisors and others, have been calling for a European or an international force. And Libyans almost always say no. But there's an increasing cross-section of Libyans who are willing to have an international force. But the question is, what role should that take? The role of international forces and the way in which international forces can help without making things worse, without being a magnet for further radicalization, as we've seen in other theaters to the east of Libya, is a major, major question. But there's definitely a role to play. And right now, there's another problem. If there's a major intervention right now, everyone will say it's because of the attack on the oil resources. See, the West only cares about oil resources. When in fact, if the West really only cared about oil resources, we already would have had a Western occupation of Libya for 4 years now. So it's just not that simple.
Also, the Security Council announced unanimously support for this agreement. What else the UN and Security Council can do to ensure the application of such an agreement?
More carrots, less sticks. As I mentioned in passing earlier, they always threaten sanctions against any Libyan that doesn't sign the agreement. How can we say it's a legitimate agreement if people are forced to sign it? You know, that's the worst way to go about building a country. And Libyans have proven that they don't care about international sanctions. In fact, most of them lived in some ways under international sanctions for decades, and they know what that's like, and they've survived that. So I think these threats of sanctions and other threats aren't the way to go. I think it's more about carrots. It's more about dividing up the pie. I think, as I've said before in this program, in many ways, the fighting in Libya is over the spoils, right? It's control of airports, seaports, border crossings, which are major sources of revenue for whatever militia or force controls that point of economic activity. And so it's very important that Libyans who look askance of any other Libyans' attempts to control anything, right, that there be a kind of international legitimating force that says, actually, no, right, whatever's happening at this airport or this border crossing or this, right, is not just for this faction, but, you know, will be feeding into the wealth of the Libyan state, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a role for the internationals in terms of military and security, but there's also a role for in the international forces and influence to sort of lend a legitimating neutral role in a country riven by communal conflict and fighting over the spoils.
What's to become of the militias in the context of this agreement?
Well, people have been saying for 4 years that we need immediate demobilization and demilitarization and regularization of the armed forces. And while that's true, if you were living in a country with no police force and no army and terrorist threats and militia threats, do you think you would turn your gun in? In fact, the militias who sold a lot of weapons onto international black markets, a lot of these weapons ended up in the Sahel and elsewhere, actually oversold. They sold too many weapons and have bought back a lot of the weapons that they got rid of, not through a demilitarization and weapons turning in, but just because they didn't have enough weaponry to defend themselves. So the way I look at it in terms of a sequence is disarming the militias is not the first step. It's the last step. 85% of the militias in Libya were pro-revolution and have nothing to do with terrorism or criminal activity. It's somewhere in the 5 to 10% are the really bad, you know, jihadists and the really bad criminal gangs. Those militias can only be controlled at this point by other militias. And so there are certain things that can be done. For example, Libya has the Libya Shield and other forces, some under the Ministry of Interior, some under the Ministry of Defense. And these can be regularized in certain ways. One of the things a lot of people don't understand about Libya is almost everyone with a gun is on a government salary right now. No. And if you cut off those government salaries, you would actually further fragment the state. You have a carrot. You have everyone's earning a salary in a militia, right? So what you could do is probably, again, carrots more than sticks, is reward the best behaved, let's say, of Libyan armed forces by regularizing them, bringing them in, not threatening them by threatening to take away their weapons, but having them be included in nation building in a constructive sort of way. And then I think we'll get to a sustainable deal in Libya more quickly.
Bill Lawrence, before we turn to Tunisia, let's look back at the international intervention in Libya, which was done to save people's lives in Benghazi. Talk about the U.S. role, this concept of, you know, leading from behind. This was a unique situation where we had the Arab League, the U.N. Security Council, all in favor of intervening. And yet things went awry. Talk about the lessons we can learn from this intervention. And what do you see as the problems, the going in itself, we're not following through in terms of the aftermath of what could be seen as a noble intervention?
Definitely the latter, although there aren't easy answers to this question. You've set it up very nicely. I think about 2 years after the intervention, everyone said Libya was worse than Syria, until Syria was much worse than Libya. And I think the Libya-Syria comparison is very instructive, because now we have a death toll in Syria, which is more than 20 times that of Libya, much more mayhem, much more arms, much more chaos. By comparison, Libya is a cakewalk to solve. And so Syria is a perfect case in point in non-intervention, or the worst type of intervention, which is flooding a country with arms without any kind of logic to it. The Libyan intervention in 2011 of NATO with a UN mandate and support of the Arab League was important because it had all that support. Basically, only the African Union wasn't supporting it, and there was a lot of regret within the African Union in 2011 and 12 for not having supported it. And there was very little, as I said earlier, killing of civilians. I think by the most accurate count, 71 civilians were killed in a NATO operation that killed thousands. And so it was actually, you know, that's 71 too many in an operation to protect civilians. But that was remarkably, say, non-radicalizing, non-destabilizing as an intervention. And there were other, let's say, a little more marginal ways in which the NATO forces delegitimized what they did a little bit. But I think those had more of an impact on academic and policy debates in Europe and universities around the world than it actually had an impact in Libya. But getting back to your core question, the problem was follow through. Now, I'm going to say something a little bit controversial here. Libyans like to blame the West, and the West likes to blame the West. Different factions of the West, you know, Republicans versus Democrats in the U.S. and the left versus the center and right in Europe. The problem is that in all this cacophony of blaming the West in various ways for everything going wrong in Libya, we've lost sight of the fact that the main failing after the revolution was Libyans not coming together. There were many moments where they could have sort of gone in a right direction and had more support from the international community, and it was never the right time. Wait till the minister gets named. Wait till the elections happen. Wait till the parliament. And they ran out the clock on international intervention and goodwill. So I put most of the blame on the failings of Libyan leadership after the revolution. But right up there, it is true that the West didn't give Libya enough bandwidth and still doesn't give Libya enough bandwidth. And so, you know, a lot of people say it's too late, but it's never too late to do things better in terms of international conflict. And I think hopefully now the West is beginning to understand how they can do a better job, and Libyan leadership is beginning to understand how they can do a better job. And that's the more important part of the equation.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is William Lawrence. He He's a visiting professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, formerly director of the North Africa and Middle East programs at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Middle East reporter in VOA's English division, Mohammed El-Shanawi. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. And here's a shout out to Hamza Amjad. He's based in Saudi Arabia. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email or like us on Facebook. William Lawrence, let's now turn to Tunisia and to get your sense of where that fledgling democracy is going. It was the recipient of a Nobel Peace Prize last year as an encouragement for its brave and courageous steps. Probably the only country now in the wake of the Arab Spring that's somewhat viable, notwithstanding the many ups and downs and terrorist attacks we've seen, its struggling economy. Do you think there's reason for optimism in Tunisia?
Yes. And the main reason is that Tunisians have chosen another path, one that to some degree no other government in the entire Middle East and North Africa region has chosen, which is including one's political opponents in the political project. Not all Tunisians believe in this. There are elements, you know, on the secular side and on the Islamist side who believe that either what's going on is a failure or an impending failure and are against this inclusivity. But there's been a solid core center of Tunisians on the secular and Islamist side of things who've hung on despite all the terrorist attacks that you mentioned and chosen the inclusive route. If you'll permit me, let me make one other comparison between Libya and Tunisia. One of the key moments where the Libyan democratic transition failed was the passing of a de-Ba'athification type law. We were calling it de-Qaddafization at the time, right? In 2013, when they voted what was called the political isolation law, excluding most of those who served under Qaddafi from serving in the government, this was one of, I would say, five or six major moments in the derailing of the Libyan democratic transition. Tunisia had a very similar moment where a very similar law in 2013 came up called the political exclusion law. And that law was poised to pass. And Ghannouchi himself, the head of the Ennahda party, went down to the parliament on the day of the vote and convinced some 20 members of the Ennahda party, as I understand the story, not to vote no, but just to abstain. They wanted to vote for it. It failed by one vote, and Bejikhaid Sebsi, the current president, would not be president, and a lot of the current ministers wouldn't be ministers if Tunisia hadn't voted down the political exclusion law, the de-Ba'athification law, that would have excluded political opponents representing in, you know, the previous regime. This is very instructive. You know, after a revolution, you have to include your political opponents, including those who supported the old regime, to a large degree in the political project going forward, or they can be spoilers. Tunisia needs all of the above, and you can't sequence these things. One of the small, bright moments for Tunisia in recent months was when the U.S., after the House passed the assistance bill for Tunisia and the Senate cut $50 million out and gave it all to Jordan, restored and increased the aid by $7.5 million. So now we've basically doubled U.S. assistance to Tunisia in 2016. We're doubling the military aid. We're doubling the economic aid and the support for democratic governance. All this important. It's a drop in the hat. Tunisia needs billions of support, not hundreds of millions. But it's a nice, serious gesture by the U.S. government to say, yes, Tunisia is important. The success of democracy in the Middle East and North Africa region is important, and we're going to invest in Tunisia's success. Part of the issue is scaling. Assistance is almost never scaled to the size of the problems. Tunisia has massive youth unemployment, for example, and I don't see any economic program coming down the pike that deals with the massive unemployment. Tunisian youth didn't vote in the last elections in 2014 by about 90%, and they're massively unemployed, and they continue to be a force for instability in Tunisia. And young men who go in large numbers to Iraq and Syria and to Libya by the thousands are also the security destabilizing force. So more of a focus on Tunisian youth. Let me just add one other thing. Tunisia has sent more fighters than any other country, except some people say Saudi has more, Iraq and Syria and to Libya. But a lot have come back. A lot went to fight the jihad against the dictator and found that they were swept up in sectarian conflict and other things, suicide bombing, they weren't interested in. They're coming back to Tunisia by the hundreds, right? And the reflex of any government, Morocco's having the same problem, the Tunisian government, is to throw them in jail or put them under surveillance. But when a fighter's given up, right, this is potentially your ally,
that is right.
Right, in messaging against the Islamic State. And so we haven't done a good job of reintegration of the hundreds coming back who have given up on this jihad. And so some of them are becoming recidivists. They're looking for a new jihad because they fall into the same miserable conditions that propelled them to go fight the jihad elsewhere. So this is another area we could do a much better job in, and I don't see much of the assistance focusing on this.
How do you explain the reported reshuffle that included ministers of interior, defense, and foreign ministry in Tunisia?
The main thing is that there's a split in Nida Tunis, the party that never held a party congress that won the last elections in a bit of a landslide. The key, I think, lesson here is that strong democratic institutions are durable. And the most democratic, durable party in Tunisia is the Islamist party right now. And Nida Tunis may be democratic sort of in a human rights sense and in terms of its rights agenda, women's rights and all that, but they don't have internal democracy. And this is a problem we see in political parties across the region. In the meantime, any ministerial reshuffle, right, is usually just window dressing to try to paper over deeper structural issues such as those I've just been mentioning.
And lastly, economically, how's Tunisia doing? You talked about massive unemployment.
Yeah.
What are they doing to deal with this? This is a critical issue.
Tunisia's made a couple of good moves along the way. They did, for example, a bond issue during the Jomah transitional government, which soaked up a lot of the black market capital in Tunisia and turned it around in a productive way for the government. They have tried employment programs for youth, which haven't been that successful because it's government jobs. But generally speaking, Tunisia got hit hard by this series of terrorist events. About 10% of the economy and a much larger percentage of the workforce works in tourism. And so that whole sector is dragging down the entire economy. But people often forget terrorism also affects foreign direct investment. And so a lot of the foreign direct investments dried up. The Tunisian Enterprise Fund, which is one of the U.S. funds, is now at $60 million with a new assistance. But they've only dispersed $2 million of assistance so far because they haven't even found where to invest it in startups in Tunisia. So there's a problem of capacity in the Tunisian private sector. And ultimately, the traditional public sector and the traditional private sector in Tunisia isn't going to be able to create all the jobs. It's going to have to be entrepreneurial small businesses, like in every economy, like in the U.S. economy, most job growth is small business service sector. And so the faster we can get to investing in pushing forward Tunisian startups, Tunisian investment of all kinds, using this hugely university educated. I mean, Tunisia doesn't even have a youth bulge. Tunisia has a post-demographic transition population that the biggest structural problem is not just too many young people like you have, say, in Morocco and Algeria, but too many university-educated young people. So all interventions in Tunisia economically, I think, should do a better job of harnessing these large numbers of university graduates with little to do. I've been advocating for 2 years now national service, where you would have groups of university graduates tackling large social issues, literacy, public health issues, and any rural electrification or water projects, renewable energy. You could do a lot with the university-educated young people in Tunisia, and right now they're sitting around waiting for a revolutionary payout that isn't coming.
And of course, Tunisia's success is also bound up with, as we return to our initial topic, Libya's success. So therefore, we have to hope that this unity government can go forward in an effective way, because otherwise Tunisia will also remain unstable as long as its neighbor is unstable.
Absolutely. The two are very locked together in terms of failing together or succeeding together.
William Lawrence is a North Africa and Middle East expert. He's a visiting professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. Well, William Lawrence, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
It's been a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill. And joining me on the program was Mohammed El-Shenawy, Middle East reporter in VOA's English division. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.